You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
From the heart of where innovation, money, and power collide, in Silicon Valley and beyond, this is Bloomberg Technology with Emily Chang.
Jack in San Francisco, and this is Bloomberg Technology. Coming up in the next hour, NVIDIA misses on revenue by more than $1 billion. Assigned demand for PCs, gaming consoles, and other electronics might be drying up after a two-year pandemic boom. We'll talk about just how long the slump could last. Plus, Apple is being picky when it comes to M&A, why the iPhone maker has slowed down its buying spree despite a $179 billion war chest. And is Facebook really the underdog now, or are we underestimating it? We'll count the ways in which TikTok still doesn't even come close to Meta. All of that in a moment, but first sticking with NVIDIA, the graphics chip giant missing its own quarterly revenue projections by more than $1 billion. Evidence that demand for electronics components is drying up after a two-year pandemic boom. Bloomberg's Ian King, who covers all things semiconductors, joins us now. And wow, $1 billion miss is not something you normally associate with Jensen Huang and NVIDIA. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a surprise that it happened, given what Intel had said, what AMD had said, what other PC-related kind of components makers had said. But I think the extent to which they fell short and the sort of rapidity with which demand has obviously fallen away, that has obviously caused a lot of concern. And that's what the analysts and investors have been talking about today.
Why did they get their own projections so wrong?
Yeah, I mean, they said, oh, it just happened so quickly, it fell off so rapidly that we didn't see this coming. The concern, or if you like, the underlying suspicion is that it's not just consumers and not just gaming related, but also this crypto dependency that they said that they'd shared. Our chips aren't good for crypto mining anymore, you don't need to worry about that. But then we see cryptocurrencies obviously been through a rough time. No reason to be mining in a lot of situations now. Maybe those cards are coming back into the gaming market.
They also pre-announced. I mean, how unusual is this?
Relatively unusual, but again, to be fair to NVIDIA, at least they did. One of the big themes on Intel's kind of disaster call last week was, why didn't you pre-announce when it was so bad? You know, investors don't like surprises. The fact that they did is, as you say, unusual, but at least they're being forthright and they're being given some credit by at least some of the analysts for doing that.
So are they clearing inventory, and is this something that will be cleared, you know, say by the next quarter?
That's the positive scenario. The positive scenario says this is what the chip industry does. They overbuild, they get it wrong, they can't match these supply with short-term demand movements. As soon as we clear out the inventory, we're back to normalized situation, everything's okay. That's the positive picture. The negative is like consumer demand.
Meantime, they've been investing in the server market, and that's actually helped kind of cushion the blow, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely right. That's why they're the world's, you know, most valuable chip company, because they've built this incredible server chip business. But even that missed today.
So what does this say about the broader state of the chip industry? I mean, did anybody expect the pandemic boom to last indefinitely? I mean, come on.
Well, you're remembering it perfectly. How many times, right, did we talk about this? How many times did chip and industry CEOs tell you things are different now? The PC market is a much higher level. Everything's okay. Every household needs 3 or 4 PCs. Everything's going to be okay. And here we are in the middle of 2022 saying that's absolutely not true.
All right, Yan King, thank you for all the extra details there. We'll be watching. Shares of Galaxy Digital rising Monday despite reporting a $550 million loss. Bloomberg's Shanali Basak and Caroline Hyde spoke with Novogratz about the state of the crypto winter. Take a listen.
We've had one credit loss in the history of our company, and I disclosed the name today. It's a manageable loss relative to our balance sheet, relative to our credit business. Our credit business actually was profitable on the quarter. I feel pretty good about that. What we saw away from us was huge concentration in this one name, which created a lot of the systemic risk that we saw and the cascading of Bitcoin all the way to 18,000. I don't have a crystal ball. When I add up the total claims that people filed, it doesn't feel like there'll be a lot that comes back in that case. You know, you've got Celsius, you've got Voyager, you've got lots of other places where both institutions and retail lost a lot of money.
Right.
And there will be a business for that where people are bidding on.
I want to double down on retail because you brought it up. You know, you mentioned earlier that you're skeptical of a soft landing. And to the extent that means you mean there's a recession coming, that it'll be a hard landing, how much money will there really be on the sidelines to put into crypto, let alone any risk asset?
Listen, you know, the Fed increased money supply at a rate that we'd never seen before, and they're slowly withdrawing that. There's still a ton of money in the system, right? There was excess savings in retail. That's getting worn down some, but there's monster cash holdings. People got really nervous. I mean, we had a pretty dramatic sell-off in the first half of the year. And so I don't think we're going to see what we saw last year when money's flowing in and it's all booming, but I don't think it's Armageddon here yet either. And so, again, I will Bitcoin get through 30,000 on this move up? We'll see. I'm doubtful. I think we're going to probably be in this range now. I'd quite frankly be happy if we're in a 22,000 or 20,000, 30,000 range for a while with the next move breaking up. Ethereum's got a little bit more juice. It's at the top of its range. It can, if it takes out 2,200, it could go higher. That's got a real story. But I don't see, the mania that we saw in 2021 or 2017 reigniting. Listen, I hope I'm wrong.
Galaxy Digital CEO Mike Novogratz there. Meantime, Apple used to acquire a company every 3 to 4 weeks, but has dramatically slowed its deal making in the last 2 years. Apple spent $1.5 billion on payments tied to acquisitions in fiscal year 2020, but just over $200 million in the last 10 months. Bloomberg's Mark Gurman here to discuss. So why is Apple slowing down the pace of deals, Mark?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, when you look at this chart, when you think about it, the first two things you might, reasons you might propose is one, COVID, right? COVID messed up, everyone's business plan. You have to tear it all up and start over, right? The second is regulation. Obviously, you have the FTC going after NVIDIA, Microsoft deals. You have the Activision deal for nearly $70 billion. You have Meta, Amazon, all these players spending so much money, and the regulators suing them and trying to get in their way. And so maybe Apple is fearful of that, as a new note inside of the regulatory filings to the SEC may suggest. But I think it's really neither of those. Because you look, 2020, that was really the height of the pandemic. In that year, they spent more than they had since 2014, right? I also think that Apple is not spending amounts of money that necessarily would lead to scrutiny from the FTC in other governments globally, right? So I think this is a matter of fact of their product development schedule, one. Two, investing in other areas. And three, maybe they're trying to go at it more alone, right, without needing to acquire companies. But at the same time, this is extremely odd. I would bet that most people don't know that Siri, Face ID, Touch ID, Apple Music, Apple News, the weather app, I could sit here for 10 minutes giving you a list of iPhone features that we all use every day. Those all stemmed from acquisitions. And so buying smaller companies and startups and core technologies and engineering teams has been core to the Apple development process ever before, since Steve Jobs even returned to the company in the late 90s.
That's interesting, because Apple has never been one to make big acquisitions, certainly not to the scale that Mark Zuckerberg has, for example. How is them not making these smaller acquisitions over at least the last year going to impact the product development cycle?
You know, I would look at it this way. I think that these acquisitions have helped Apple get to where they want to get much more quickly, right? And at lower costs, you know, per se, right? I'll give you my favorite Apple acquisition is probably Authentech back in 2012, right? They bought that company, and all that company did was make very secure and reliable fingerprint scanners, right? And that led to Touch ID on the iPhone 5S in 2013. Remember how cool that was, right? And so those little things, even though they're not big deals, led to some pretty cool features that have helped them sell new phones, right? And to answer your question, I think they should really be snapping up autonomous car companies in general, car manufacturing, to really bring that Apple car closer to fruition. Remember when Elon Musk said that Apple buying Tesla on the table for a market cap around $60 billion was on the table about 5 years ago, before the Model 3 came out? Imagine if Apple would have bought Tesla back then, how different the car industry would look today for just a $60 billion deal. And when I say just, if you compare a $60 billion deal compared to Apple's cash balance over the last decade or so, right, it is small potatoes. So I think their acquisition strategy has paid off in a lot of ways, but we're seeing some changes here, at least for the last two fiscal years.
All right, Mark Gurman in LA. Thanks, Mark, as always.
Thanks.
All right, coming up. Digital rights in a post-Roe world, how to navigate what can and can't be used against you when it comes to your web searches. That is next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
The companies provide a very important service that allows people to access information about their healthcare.
Tech companies could choose to provide that information, provide free security services to websites disseminating that information so they're protected from vigilante hackers.
The other things that tech companies can do is become very prepared to go into court and actually push back against the requests that they get from law enforcement.
They have enough data on all of us to serve their business model. They don't need data about people's private health choices in order to make money.
And if they are disregarding the rights and welfare of the people that they are serving through the technologies that they provide, those people are going to be less and less able to participate.
As abortion restrictions tighten in various states across the United States, questions remain about privacy. How will new laws be enforced in the digital age? Privacy advocates warn that location and other kinds of data could be used to track individuals who visit abortion clinics or travel across state lines. Joining me now to dig deeper into this is Alexandra Givens, president of the Center for Democracy and Technology. Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us. So what's not being talked about when we think about the power that these companies have and the threat that our information could be used against us?
I think this really is a wake-up moment for the tech companies to think about the sheer amount of information that they have and to know that their users want that information to be protected. So we need companies thinking about just how much data they collect, how long they store it for, where they're sharing it with, and getting really smart about how they respond to law enforcement requests as well.
What kind of data are you most worried about that these companies have?
So right after the news of the overturning of Roe v. Wade came out, there was a big conversation about period tracking apps. And that matters, but users need to realize that there's a lot more they should be focused on. We're talking about your browser information, what websites you visited, your search history, your online purchases, if somebody purchases medication that could be used in the case of an abortion. And then also the subject matter of your texts and emails. And finally, your location information, which can be collected by your phone, by app, on your phone, and also by your internet service provider as well.
How should tech companies prepare themselves to deal with this?
They need to think about a couple different things. One is just their data collection practices in the first place. We are about to enter a world where law enforcement is asking these companies to hand over their customers' most sensitive information for prosecutions that are wildly unpopular when you look at the broader American public. So companies need to think about what they're collecting, how long they're keeping it for, and then also how they are responding to these law enforcement requests if they get them. They need to be requiring a warrant. They need to be fighting to make sure that those warrants are narrowly tailored. They need to be pushing back for law enforcement doing overbroad phishing expeditions, and they need to be telling users about the requests that they're getting so we can have more transparency in the space.
You've also talked about how worried you are about a chilling effect on free speech when it comes to information around abortion. Can you explain that?
There's a big conversation to be had here around online content moderation. So how companies can make sure that they're helping people get access to reliable, accurate information about abortion services, pushing away mis- and disinformation, and then also just pushing back on the growing number of state laws we're likely to see of state legislatures trying to make it illegal to post online information about how to access reproductive care. So we need the companies to be thinking about what they're curating, what are the signals they can put online to help give access to good healthcare information, fairly similar to what they've had to do under COVID, really, and also make sure that they are not falling for these statutes that try to limit access to good information about reproductive care.
Are there ways that big tech companies could help women wanting to make this choice or who feel like they have no choice but to make this quote-unquote choice?
Yeah, I mean, it's all about knowing your options, right? It's about a woman being able to understand the circumstances that she's in and make an informed decision. And so some of the things that we've seen companies do, which I admire and like, is, for example, if a person searches for abortion services, what are the ads that can come up against that search, down the bar on the side of your search engine? How do we make sure that those are from certified providers? They are trusted ads. They're not from places that actually are trying to trap people that are seeking information about abortion care. And we have reason to believe in this climate that crisis pregnancy centers, which come from the anti-abortion movement, might well be trying to target people who are running those searches. So there are things like that. What are the indicators for trusted information that platforms can do? And then how can they really quickly respond to fraudulent websites, websites that are trying to entrap people seeking information for care, and de-escalating the spread of viral mis- and disinformation about abortion services as well?
What are your biggest fears about how technology could potentially be used against us?
I think they're starting to come true already, which is the fear that these are going to be used in prosecutions. And also, when you look at some of these state statutes, it's not just law enforcement prosecutions against people who are seeking or providing reproductive care, but there are some statutes out there that authorize individual citizens to go out as private bounty hunters and file their own lawsuits against people that they suspect of aiding and abetting abortions. That's really dangerous because it creates this incentive system for, you know, the Wild West, for Lone Rangers to go out there, be tracking down information about their neighbors, bringing these lawsuits with the promise of the state paying them a $10,000 bounty if they do so. That is a really worrying environment for people's privacy and ability to access good information online. So that is the type of landscape that the tech companies just should not want to get themselves in the middle of. And that is why we need the tech companies really limiting their collection of sensitive health information that could be used to create an inference that somebody has accessed abortion services or any other type of reproductive care that could expose them to litigation or prosecution.
It's potentially very terrifying. Have you seen any particular examples where this has happened or where this is happening already?
So there have already been cases, even before the overturning of Roe v. Wade, there were women who were being prosecuted for their pregnancy outcomes, being accused of self-inducing miscarriages late in their term. And what was used in those prosecutions were people's browsing histories, their online purchase history, evidence that they had purchased certain medications online. And then even in one case, the subject and the contents of a woman's text messages with a friend as she was trying to get advice on what to do. So we've seen already in these cases that digital evidence can be used in evidence against you. And so that's a reason why users need to be careful and why the companies really need to be watching this as well.
Chilling indeed. Alexandra Givens, thank you for shedding light on this issue. Really appreciate it. President of the Center for Democracy and Technology. Thank you for stopping by. Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco. SoftBank says it will sell some or all of its shares in SoFi. Reported holdings equivalent to a 9% stake. SoftBank reporting a record net loss as a sell-off in global tech stocks continues to hammer its Vision Fund portfolio. I want to get back to markets now. Shares of EV makers and clean energy companies jumping after the U.S. Senate passed a landmark bill on climate. Our Ed Ludlow back with the mover. Ed?
Yeah, so the bill moved those you'd expect them to. A lot of EV names, $374 billion of energy and climate spending is earmarked. You look at names like Tesla, actually been up much higher, around 5%, but closing up 0.8%. And some of these smaller EV makers and legacy names like GM and Ford, it ends the per manufacturer limit on the $7,500 tax credit, which is something we'd expected. It'd been negotiated for many months. And of course, that's seen as a tailwind for demand. But there are price limits. Anything over $55,000 for an EV car or sedan is not eligible, and anything over $80,000 for a pickup or SUV is not eligible. But this is what we've been waiting for, the government to kind of give this industry a bit of a push, get it going. Not done much for the stock so far this year, though. You look at the performance of Tesla versus legacy names like GM and Ford year to date. They're still under pressure, and we're still seeing significant declines. But I walk over to this side of the screen, and you do see Ford in particular closing that share gap on Tesla in terms of year-to-date performance because they are starting to ramp up their own activity. And again, with government support, there is hope that they'll see more. It wasn't just EVs as well. There are measures within the bill for support for renewable energy, not just in the form of solar, but also in hydrogen plug-in as well. And you see some names here across solar moving pretty significantly on the back of that bill being negotiated overnight. Not all the way there, goes to the House next, but the expectation, even though this is trimmed out down from where we started a year ago, is that this is a really big play, ultimately, to reduce carbon emission by 40% from where we were in 2005. Interesting development.
All right, Ed, thank you. Well, Mark Zuckerberg's new narrative for Meta has consistently involved pitching Facebook's platforms as the underdog, especially when it comes to regulation and competition. But Facebook may be in a better position to take on TikTok than Zuckerberg is leading the public to believe. According to Bloomberg Businessweek's Max Chafkin, in a different regulatory environment, Zuckerberg might simply try to buy TikTok. That's not possible at the moment. Thus, his strategy is evolving. Max Chafkin joins me now. So does anybody really believe Mark Zuckerberg when he says Meta is an underdog?
Well, I mean, we've seen, a raft of stories all about the existential challenges facing Facebook. And of course, investors have sent the stock down something like 50% since February. So there are definitely people out there with concerns. And I think what's happening is that Zuckerberg is kind of leaning into them. So you do have economic challenges, right? So Facebook really benefited from COVID stay-at-home orders and the sort of explosion of e-commerce shopping. That's all gone away. And then you do have this kind of cultural challenge where TikTok is, you know, getting a lot of mind share. It seems like a lot of the younger people, of course, are into TikTok. They're not into Facebook. And Zuckerberg's using that and saying, you know, we're really in trouble. We're going to have this intense period. He's kind of rattling the saber in terms of hiring, telling employees, you know, they shouldn't take vacations and, you know, they need to weed out the bad performers. And I think this is, as you say, it's strategic. It's both an effort to try to get more productivity out of his staff and also a kind of a positioning thing, because Facebook faces serious antitrust scrutiny on a couple of different fronts. And playing up challenges from competition is, of course, one way to kind of diffuse a situation.
How would you assess Facebook's position of power with respect to TikTok? You know, what does Facebook have on TikTok? Well, and what is TikTok's actual advantage?
Yeah, so Facebook, it's really easy to sort of forget this, but Facebook is like way, way, way bigger than TikTok. We don't know exactly how much money TikTok is making, but, you know, independent estimates put it at $4 billion in revenue in 2021. And Facebook, you know, is something like over $100 billion, right? They're making like eight times TikTok's revenue in profit for the year. Now, TikTok could, you know, and there is a lot of chatter about this. You know, TikTok's going to sort of turn on the cash machine and is going to find ways to make money, but they haven't done that yet. And there's really no reason to think that they will be any better at monetizing than Mark Zuckerberg is, because what Facebook has built is this kind of incredible cash machine for turning online attention into revenue. And he has, as you know, has been well documented, basically a monopoly on social media advertising. And TikTok is certainly eating into that, but really it's a very long way away from eating Mark Zuckerberg's lunch.
That said, TikTok does seem to be way, way, way winning the attention war with Facebook, or is that also a misperception?
Well, I think that's absolutely true, but it's easy to forget that lots of other companies have won this attention war. Facebook, you know, there's been a lot of people have pointed out that Facebook's kind of lost its cool or something like that. But what that kind of overlooks is it's lost its cool for like the last 10 years, right? Facebook lost its cool first to Instagram. There was, you know, Twitter was the hot thing for a while. And over time, Mark Zuckerberg has found ways to maneuver the company. And now there is one important difference. Whereas in the past, you know, he would have just bought TikTok, right? That is not possible because of FTC scrutiny. You know, he could try, but it seems almost certain that the government would try to block it, given that they're trying to block this much smaller acquisition. So that's something that is not available to him. But what is available to him is copying. And we're seeing Facebook do that with its Reels product and with these efforts to have more, you know, AI-driven discovery, basically like a TikTok-like interface. Those are the complaint that's what led to all these complaints from, you know, Instagram influencers and Kardashian-adjacent types. But the thing is, we know this is working in part because Facebook has said one reason their revenue is lower, has been lower, is because they're driving users into these TikTok-like platforms, which do not monetize as well. So they're making a choice. They're choosing, you know, copying TikTok versus driving revenue. And on one hand, you could say, well, that bodes ill, right? That suggests they're not monetizing well. On the other hand, it does look like they're making progress in terms of this copycat approach. And again, I don't see any reason to think that it won't work. It's worked, you know, many times before in the history of this company.
All right. Great piece by you. Bloomberg Businessweek, Max Chafkin, as always, great to have you. Coming up, Bitcoin and Coinbase both rallying. Is winter getting a little warmer? FTX U.S. President Brett Harrison joins us to weigh in on that question next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Coinbase shares rallied for a fifth straight day as investors continue to pile in to the largest U.S. crypto exchange following news of its partnership with BlackRock to help institutional investors manage and trade Bitcoin. This as Bitcoin also rallying, breaking above the $24,000 mark. Welcome news for the crypto platform ahead of its second quarter results after the close of market later this week. Here to discuss what's happening this winter, I want to bring in FTX US President Brett Harrison for his read on this and much more. So what do you make of this Coinbase BlackRock news, Brett?
So it does seem to be that the winter is starting to thaw here. You know, prices are obviously rising. And what are we actually seeing here? A lot of these sort of forced liquidations in the market, they're starting to come to an end. No more news about different other exchanges or lending platforms going under. Voyager is returning funds. Large undeployed venture capital starting to be deployed again. And then, of course, this news coming out with Coinbase and with BlackRock showing that the institutional demand to be able to trade crypto through some of the more traditional huge players in the market is not slowed down. And in fact, as the saying goes, that this is the time to build. People are obviously building now. And as we start to come out of this winter and people are trading again, the tools, the capital will be in place to do so. And of course, all of this against the backdrop of more progress in Congress, Stabenow Boozman coming out with their big crypto bill, a lot of positive signs around that, all in bringing a positive sentiment to crypto markets and to the equity markets that are relating to crypto.
Still, you've got Coinbase and Robinhood slashing their headcount. What mistakes do you think these companies made when they were scaling?
You know, looking across the growth tech sector, there are so many companies talking about either layoffs or hiring freezes. I mean, everything from, yes, Coinbase and Robinhood, but also Google and Microsoft and Tesla. I think there's a real lesson learned here, which is that these growth companies, which typically have operated under the model that headcount growth is a sign of company growth, are realizing that actually sometimes headcount growth can get in the way of company growth. If you don't have a lean staff where you can prioritize the most important build outs, where you can get things done, you can move nimbly with a market that moves extremely quickly like crypto, it's going to be difficult to keep pace. And when there's a winter and things are slowing down, retail volume is drying up, and you have to focus on the most important things, that means you'll have to pull back on those employees, which can be devastating to build up this giant workforce and then have to lay those people off who have worked so hard for their company. I mean, that's why I think that companies like FTX, but of course, we're not the only company to do this, showing that you can operate with a leaner model, with a smaller team, and really be able to focus on the highest priority items at all time and get things done is super important for you to be able to weather even the downturns in the market.
FTX has been really acquisitive through this winter, and I wonder if winter is starting to thaw, how does that impact your strategy around deals? Do you expect valuations to stay low or start to creep up, and could that mean less opportunities?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you said, you know, during this past, let's say, couple of months, there have been a lot of opportunities presented to us as far as potential deals with, you know, either companies that are looking for capital injections. They need help, you know, getting back in business. There's possible merger opportunities, lower private equity valuations. And yes, as investor confidence starts to come back into this sector, I mean, those opportunities will start to dry up as, you know, these companies will start to get their volumes back. They'll start to get revenue again. They'll want to, you know, be able to increase their, you know, existing pipeline of projects and capital in the same way they were before. But there's still plenty of opportunities in the market and certainly ones that we're looking at.
FTX is expanding its no-stock trading fee to all of its U.S. users, including non-crypto investors. What's the end game here? Is Robinhood a competitor or still a potential target for some kind of stake?
I mean, it's certainly the case that they're a competitor. I mean, they've been a competitor for a while. When they started out in the stock trading business, and then they added crypto. They added the ability to trade Bitcoin, Ether on their platform. They've since been adding more and more assets. I think just today they added Avalanche. And so they have realized that their customer demand for retail crypto trading is incredible. And so they've been a competitor to us for quite some time. What we've realized is that we can do a great job providing a stock trading platform to our users as well. We can do so without relying on payment for order flow. We can give people more advanced analytics and tools to be able to make smarter investment decisions. We want to make our platform more one that is involved with, you know, educating our users on how to make, you know, how to do trades in a responsible way as opposed to being more kind of gamified. And so in that sense, we think that we have a good shot at competing with them on this platform. And we're pretty excited about all of the initial user growth that we've seen in trading stocks in FTX US.
You've also, you know, made a number of different sports partnerships. Your name is on some arenas now, partnership with Major League Baseball. How much are these sport partnerships, sponsorships actually paying off?
Yeah, it's hard to put a, you know, quantification on that number of exactly how much it's paid off. We think that from a qualitative perspective, it's been tremendously important for our brand. Think about that. 1 year ago, almost no one in the U.S. had heard of FTX U.S. We were going up against, you know, Coinbase and Kraken and Gemini and different companies that have been around for a decade. And in an industry that requires the trust in your brand that cryptocurrency does, with all the noise out there, with exchanges going down, with hacks, with the scams, you have to establish that brand presence, especially in the United States. And for us, doing things like partnering with the Major League Baseball or, you know, putting our name in the FTX arena basically catapulted us into the public consciousness in a way that, you know, going this more traditional advertising route, such as Google ads or Facebook ads, wouldn't have been able to achieve in such a short period of time.
All right. Brett Harrison, president of FTX US. Always good to have you, Brett. Thank you for stopping by.
Thank you so much.
As families ease into the back-to-school season throughout the country, let's take a look at trends in the world of education technology. Duolingo, for one, beat analyst estimates during its second quarter earnings report last week, even boosted its revenue guidance for the year. I want to talk about this and more with Duolingo CEO and co-founder Luis Von Ahn. So going into a new school year, Luis, is the pandemic boom, has that been keeping up or is it starting to wane?
Well, you know, the pandemic was interesting for us. It wasn't a crazy boom. I mean, we did benefit a little bit from the pandemic, but we had been growing steadily since before the pandemic. And, you know, a lot of people have asked us if afterwards our users went down or anything, but we didn't see any of that. And I think it's just because we have users in every single country in the world and, you know, in every socioeconomic, in the whole part of the socioeconomic spectrum.
So what are the most interesting themes going into this particular year, now that schools generally have been basically open for about a year since COVID?
I think one of the things that is interesting is that schools in general have just adopted educational technology a lot more. and we're going to continue seeing that. So we're expecting a big back-to-school bump. We usually get it around this year. You know, Duolingo is used by about half of all schools in the United States for teaching foreign languages. And so we're very excited about that. I think generally educational technology is just here to stay.
You've actually been leaning into TikTok when it comes to ad spend. Talk to us a little bit about that and why.
Well, it's actually not ad spend. We have been leaning into TikTok, but it's all organic. I mean, really, the spend that we have on our TikTok is really the salary of our employees who run the account. We're blessed that we have a very lovable mascot, Duolingo, Duo the Owl, and we make all these videos that go viral. Some of them have them, you know, our mascot dancing, etc. So that's worked out really well for us. It's about 10% of our users in the U.S., new users in the U.S. come from TikTok, and it's been very efficient. I mean, again, the main spend there is just the salary of the couple of people that run it.
Interesting, because we were talking about TikTok versus Facebook and Instagram earlier, and I'm curious how you would assess the impact and power of both. I mean, do you see TikTok as more powerful or potentially a lot more powerful than the other two platforms?
Well, for us, TikTok has just been significantly more powerful. I think some of it just has to do with the fact that it's on these days. It's kind of the cool thing. But it's also, you know, the algorithm really rewards content that is enjoyable. And I think we've managed to create very enjoyable kind of viral content that has worked out very, very well for us.
Duolingo is back in China's app stores after a 1-year hiatus. Talk to us about the impact of the crackdown and how much did that set you back?
Yeah, well, China's a very interesting market for everything, but for language learning. It's the largest language learning market in the world. But for us, the Chinese market has always been relatively small. It's only about 1% of our revenue and also of our daily active users. About 9 months ago or so, we got taken down from the app stores, which what it meant is our all the users that already had Duolingo could continue using us, but new users could not get in there. About a month ago or so, we were reinstated and we started growing again. And at this point, we're back to the traffic levels that we had before we got taken down. But for us, even though it's a very interesting market, we also know that Western companies usually don't do super well in China. So, you know, it's an interesting market, but it's only about 1% of our revenues.
Now, you know, we're facing a difficult macro environment, inflation, you know, the R word we're hearing over and over again. Sometimes it's, you know, more impending than not. How are you expecting that to impact your business and the edtech market in general? Is this a discretionary market where, you know, if companies or customers are going to have to choose, they'll spend less here?
Well, we haven't seen any kind of weakness in our numbers. I mean, we beat our estimates. We increased our guidance for the quarter. And I think some of it just has to do with the fact that we're still pretty early in our journey. Language learning is a very large market. It's about $60 billion a year, but most of it is still offline. So if you think about the language learning market, most of it is kind of people learning English in night school in Brazil or something like that. And it's shifting online, like, you know, the way dating shifted online over the last 20 years, language learning is still kind of shifting online. So we're still in the early parts of our growth in terms of user growth and also in terms of revenue growth. So we just haven't seen any weakness in our numbers. The other thing about us is we have a freemium model where, people can learn as much as they want on Duolingo entirely for free. And then they can actually turn off the ads if, you know, they pay. So far, we just, you know, this just hasn't affected us at all.
Interesting. All right. Luis Fanon, CEO and co-founder of Duolingo. Thank you so much for joining us and giving a snapshot of what's going on in your industry. That does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. Later this week, Tuesday, we've got Lemonade CEO Daniel Schreiber with us to talk about their results, plus how inflation is weighing on consumers. And don't forget to check out our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.